From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
We will hear argument this morning in case 23939, Trump versus United States.
It was a historic day at the Supreme Court. For the first time, the justices were considering whether former presidents have immunity from prosecution for actions they took while in office, a question they've never needed to answer before. Donald Trump claims he has absolute presidential immunity and that special counsel Jack Smith can't try him for trying to overturn his 2020 election loss. But Smith says no one is above the law. During oral arguments, the liberal and conservative justices seem to have different concerns. The conservatives, like Justice Samuel Alito, were concerned that presidents without immunity would be subjected to abusive prosecutions after leaving office, while the liberals, like Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, were concerned that presidents with immunity would be emboldened to commit crimes while in office.
I mean, the presidents have to make a lot of tough decisions about enforcing the law, and they have to make decisions about questions that are unsettled. And they have to make decisions based on the information that's available. Do you really, did I understand you to say, well, you know, if he makes a mistake, he makes a mistake. He's subject to the criminal laws just like anybody else. You don't think he's in a special, a peculiarly precarious position?
You seem to be worried about the president being chilled. I think that we would have a really significant opposite problem if the president wasn't chilled. If someone with those kinds of powers, the most powerful person in the world with the greatest amount of authority, could go into office knowing that there would be no potential penalty for committing crimes. I'm trying to understand what the disincentive is from turning the Oval Office into, the seat of criminal activity in this country.
Considering the conservatives' questions during the oral arguments, it appears that Trump's trial for election interference is unlikely to take place before the election, and that delay is certainly a win for Trump. Joining me is constitutional law expert Michael Dorff, a professor at Cornell Law School. Mike, these oral arguments seem to be all over the place. What was your general impression?
So I was surprised that I was surprised. And what I mean by that is I have long regarded Trump's arguments here as pretty insubstantial, and therefore I was surprised at how seriously the court was taking it. But I should be surprised at my surprise, because they set the case for briefing and full oral argument a while back. That means that at least four justices thought that there was enough here to warrant plenary consideration rather than simply disposing of it in the way that Jack Smith had asked them to. Having said that, I'll add that I was at least a little bit pleased that nobody seemed especially taken by what I regard as the weakest of Trump's argument, which is this notion that the impeachment clause requires, as a precondition for prosecuting a former president, that that former president have been impeached and removed. But that was about all that pleased me, because there were so many other, in my view, very implausible claims that were given serious credence. So you had Justice Gorsuch and Justice Alito and Justice Thomas asking questions based on hypothetical examples involving, you know, a corrupt Justice Department in the future, about planning a coup overseas, which was about all sorts of things that are, you know, potentially troubling if they were to arise, and ignoring the real thing that just happened.
It struck me as well, because several of the justices, and I think Alito, Kavanaugh, and Gorsuch, said, you know, I'm not really concerned about the facts here.
Right.
We're concerned about hampering the power of future presidents. Justice Gorsuch said, we're writing an opinion here for the ages.
Yes, and that is a fair point in general, right? In any particular case, the Supreme Court isn't merely resolving the case. It's also making law that will apply in future cases. But one would think if ever there's an occasion to focus especially on the particular fact before you, it's here where we have an unprecedented set of actions, at this point officially only alleged with respect to the criminal justice system, but unprecedented actions by a sitting president to attempt an overthrow of an election. You know, so I guess it's a little bit like saying, well, you don't want to use the fire extinguisher on a grease fire in your kitchen because, you know, it could damage the wall. Yeah, it could damage the wall, but if you don't use it now, the whole house is going to go up on fire. The focus on these remote hypotheticals at the expense of the very substantial damage in the here and now is, I guess the most polite way I could say it, is misguided.
Very polite. So did all or most of the justices reject or express skepticism about Trump's sweeping claims of absolute presidential immunity?
I think that's right, with the possible exception of Justice Thomas. It's not that Justice Thomas accepted it, but he didn't really say anything about it. He seemed interested in the difference between personal and official actions, and that was part of the theory of Trump's lawyer, Mr. Sauer, anyway. So, you know, it's hard to say. I think there was something misleading about the argument if you weren't paying close attention. That is, you know, accepting the framing of, well, we need to distinguish between actions that are in an official capacity versus those that are in a personal capacity could be consistent with the extreme version of Trump's theory. Because, of course, even the extreme version says, well, you know, and for prosecuting the president for a murder he committed while president, but as part of a love triangle, then that would be permissible. Although I heard Sauer say, well, it would be impermissible if he did it by having someone in the FBI do it for him, because giving orders to the FBI is an official function.
So as you mentioned, there were all these hypotheticals to test whether a president's act would be considered official or private. But Justice Amy Coney Barrett actually read some of the charges and asked Trump's attorney whether they were official or private acts.
Petitioner conspired with another private attorney who caused the filing in court of a verification signed by petitioner that contained false allegations to support a challenge.
That also sounds private.
So do you think the decision will come down to the distinction between official acts and private acts?
So I think that's probably the most likely way to get to 5 votes. I suspect that if there is a 5-justice majority for a version of that question that still permits the case to go forward substantially, the 5 main votes are the 3 Democratic appointees, Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Barrett. It's possible they would pick up Justice Gorsuch on that, but maybe not. I thought that of the Republican appointees, Justice Barrett was the one who seemed to be taking the prosecution the most seriously, right? Because she wanted to know whether there would be a way to articulate some test that gives some kind of immunity for some core of official acts, but still have the case move forward quickly. I think that's a nice wish. If that's what she's sincerely trying to do, I admire her for doing so. But I think that basically the court, you know, put the kibosh on this prosecution when they set it for oral argument. We're not going to get an opinion, probably not until late June. You know, you're not going to get jury selection immediately, right? The earliest you get a trial under the best of circumstances is October. And that's just not going to happen. The judge is not going to schedule a trial for the month before the presidential election. So it almost doesn't matter unless, right, Trump loses the election, and then the case goes forward during the second Biden administration.
Besides the official versus private, is there another way you see them deciding this?
Well, I see other obstacles. I mean, there were various points during the oral argument where some of the justices suggested that the former president can't be prosecuted under any statute that doesn't specifically list the president, right? So that if a statute says anybody who commits murder, you know, shall be subject to prosecution, that doesn't include the president because it said anybody, but, you know, the president isn't anybody, he's the president. So, you know, I don't think there are five votes for saying that, but I think someone might be attracted to that. Justice Thomas, at one point early in the argument, suggested that the very existence of a special prosecutor might be unconstitutional. Justice Kavanaugh had, you know, that bizarre couple of minutes when he's just sort of giving a dramatic reading of Justice Scalia's dissent from Morrison against Olson, which also was critical of the independent counsel. So, you know, there's a whole lot of sort of dirt that was kind of just kicked up. And I think it's unlikely that many of those things ends up commanding a majority, but it will likely delay the release of the opinion till the very last day of the term. And then whatever additional procedure is called for is going to add further delay. So again, I'm less focused on the exact outcome than I am on the delay, because I don't think there are five votes, there may not even be one vote, for saying that the president is simply absolutely immune. But I do think there are at least five votes for some kind of a test that further delays trial and means it doesn't happen until after the election, if at all.
The Supreme Court has this case, the case over the January 6th obstruction charge, and the already decided case over the Colorado ballot. This court seems to be more involved in a presidential election than any court since Bush v. Gore, while at the same time it has the lowest public approval. Is that something the justices consider?
So I guess I would distinguish some of the cases. Although I think they got it wrong in the Colorado case, I think it would have been irresponsible to have left the 14th Amendment Section 3 question just to each of the 50 states and local election boards and so forth. I think what they should have done was take the case and agree with the Colorado Supreme Court. But you did sort of need a national determination with respect to whether Trump committed insurrection within the meaning of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. With respect to this case, I do think that what they've done does, at the very least, unnecessarily and, you know, dispositively delay any kind of a prosecution. As far as, you know, public opinion, I think it hasn't been true since the appointment of Justice Coney Barrett that the court really cares about that. I mean, I think that's something that Chief Justice Roberts has long cared about. I think he now realizes that he's lost that battle. And even if he still wants to fight for the court's standing, he's going to lose. And so they're just going to do what they think is the right thing to do. And, you know, I suspect that they think they're just following the law. Even Justice Alito, I believe, believes he is just following the law.
Though while ignoring a lot of precedent. Thanks so much, Mike. That's Cornell Law School professor Michael Dorf.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
While in D.C. this week, the Supreme Court was considering Donald Trump's claims of presidential immunity from criminal prosecution for election interference. In Manhattan, Donald Trump was the defendant in the first criminal trial of a former president of the United States. Trump is accused of trying to corrupt the 2016 presidential election by falsifying business records to cover up a hush money payment. In opening statements, prosecutors called it a planned, coordinated, long-running conspiracy to influence the 2016 election, while the defense attorney said Trump had nothing to do with the alleged false business records, which, by the way, weren't false. Trump echoed that outside the courthouse, saying it was a case about a payment to a lawyer that was listed as a legal expense.
What else would you call it? Actually, nobody's been able to say what you're supposed to call it. If a lawyer puts in a bill or an invoice and you pay the bill and in the book, it's a little line that's a very small little line. I don't know if you could even write more than two words. It's not like you could tell a life story. They marked it down to a legal expense. This is what I got indicted over.
Joining me to discuss trial tactics is former federal prosecutor Jeff Tsai. Jeff, in the opening statements, while the prosecutor is describing election fraud, the defense attorney is describing bookkeeping errors. Todd Bland said, what on earth is a crime? The 34 counts are really just 34 pieces of paper.
It's an attempt to try to turn a three-dimensional case into a one-dimensional or two-dimensional case. This is always going to be a pitched battle between an issue of paper or an issue of substance. And you see it in every kind of fraud case that exists. In this case, obviously dealing with a former president is no different. The defense's job front and center is going to be presenting to the jury the idea that at most this is a small c crime of paper. It is about moving things from the left side of the desk to the right side. And jury, do you want to be the ones who potentially take someone's liberty away because he didn't move the paper on the desk quite the right way? That's part of the reason why you saw the government in their opening statement start not just with the idea that we're talking about 34 felony charges, but that we're talking writ large, like take a step back about election interference. And then you also heard that phrase in the opening statement where the prosecutor talks about the idea of the former president lying, quote, over and over and over again. They're just words, of course, that the prosecutor is saying, but there is a message behind it, which is this isn't just about paper. This is also about the core things that no one likes, lying and lying about something that matters.
And the prosecution in the opening said it's about a criminal conspiracy and a cover-up. He's not charged with conspiracy.
Interesting,
is
right?
The prosecution setting the bar too high for itself?
I'll tell you, being a prosecutor and bringing cases, especially big ones like this, are complicated because there is a mission creep desire sometimes unintentional, by the way, to try to make the case too big. And often the approach that prosecutors try to take and frankly need to take in many instances is to try to avoid the mission creep and keep the cases as tight and small as possible. Not small in terms of substance, but small in terms of what you're asking a juror to put in her brain. Over the course of 6 weeks, there is going to be an extraordinary amount of information, testimony, documents, pictures. And I don't care how many notes a juror takes, it is difficult to keep all of that package together cleanly. And I don't care how great the closing argument is, it's difficult to do. So the bigger a case becomes, it can create lots of variables. And variables are ultimately the enemy for a prosecutor.
So there is the Michael Cohen problem, which I'll call the Michael Cohen problem. And he's going to be the star witness for the prosecution. The defense said he was obsessed with President Trump. He was disbarred. He's a convicted felon and a convicted perjurer. How difficult is it going to be for the prosecution to make Cohen into a believable witness?
So, you know, to the point about trying to make a case too big, I think that principle applies, especially in a circumstance where you do have what I think you accurately described as the star witness. The reality is Michael Cohen is a person who clearly made mistakes. We know this because he pleaded guilty to felony offenses. If the government attempts to try to do too much, which is to say, try to turn Michael Cohen into this kind of angelic figure, one who's almost a martyr of sorts, it can backfire because there is a certain degree to which when a jury is listening and hearing and watching evidence, they're paying attention to that very basic normal person emotion, which is, do I just trust the information this person is giving me? So there is something to be said for trying to present a witness, especially a flawed one. And frankly, most witnesses and people are flawed. Presenting the information in such a way that says this is a person who made mistakes. This is a person who is coming clean right now. And there is no reason for this person now to tell you anything but the truth. And I think that that's going to be really the job that the prosecutor has to undertake.
David Pecker, the former publisher of the National Enquirer, was the first prosecution witness. Explain why the prosecution put him on first.
The first witness is probably the most important evidentiary step that the government makes because it is literally the very first human being who will start presenting what is actually evidence to a jury. There is a tendency in a case like this that you put the star witness on the stand because it allows for two things. One, for the evidence to come in immediately for the jury, no waiting around. But also number two, it allows the government to buffer in some other kinds of evidence in case the star evidence doesn't come in quite as they expected. This is slightly different. It's slightly different for a couple of reasons, one of which is an important goal that the government has is to try to get corroboration in place and to try to make sure that they are not relying only on Michael Cohen's testimony. And so you have someone in the form of David Pecker who serves as a narrator of sorts, who can tell the story not in the beginning of time, but in a very important snippet of time that will allow the government to both go forwards in time and backwards in time. And that's where they then slot in Michael Cohen.
And they have asked Pecker a lot about Michael Cohen's role, and it's come out already that Trump was the one who set up Cohen as the point man.
And I got to tell you, that was not only intentional on the government's part, I think it was an important piece of what they're trying to build in their case, which is not just this notion of we want to corroborate Michael Cohen and bolster this idea that he was an important person. They also want to directly insert Donald Trump into this conversation through someone other than Michael Cohen. That's an important piece because the testimony that the jury hears from Michael Cohen is going to rely in significant part on whether the jury trusts the conversations that Michael Cohen had with Donald Trump. And that's even putting aside the recording, assuming it gets into evidence. You've got the jury having to listen to Michael Cohen's testimony, and the only thing better than having just Michael Cohen describe a conversation is to have an entirely different person say that the conversation also happened. And that's why I think you see a lot of the descriptions from David Pecker about the conversations Donald Trump was in. And I think it's going to be something that the government continues to utilize for the rest of their case.
Let's talk about Trump taking the stand. And we saw what happened in the civil case where he was on the stand for. Also, he has against him now the fact that the judge is allowing a lot of what the prosecution wants to cross-examine him. But yet I've heard people say maybe he will take the stand in this. Maybe it'll come to a point in the trial where that's the only way they have to go. I mean, what do you think?
Sometimes that's the case, and it's happened more than once where a defendant has taken the stand and it's changed the entire complexion of a case. But the reason why there's a loose general rule in criminal prosecutions and criminal defense, frankly, that a defendant should not take the stand is the fact that it creates more variability, something that we talked about before. And it applies that concept of variability as much on the defense side as it does on the prosecution side in this sense. For a defense lawyer to allow his client, her client, to take the stand, whether or not he or she, I suppose, allows it, the variability at play is partly what you said a moment ago, which is there are a number of things that now become part of those items that can cross-examine a witness. The other issue is that in the event that a judge subsequently, in the case of a conviction, at sentencing, finds that the defendant who took the stand lied on the stand, that can serve to actually increase someone's sentence. So what makes this fundamentally different from a civil trial is the fact that now your liberty's at stake. That really changes the game rather fundamentally. And so I think that the loose general principle of a defendant not taking the stand will most likely control at the end of the day in this particular trial. But of course, we're guessing as much as anyone. And I will tell you, having done a lot of trials, things change from day one to day 21 to day 31 and somewhere in between. Things can change at a moment's notice. And so especially in a situation where the defense has decided not to call a client to testify, it's often characterized to the jury as we didn't do it because, A, we don't have the burden of proof. And number two, the government's case is paltry. It's thin. It's lean. They have nothing to it. We didn't need to present anything to you. And I think that's what you might see in the event they don't put Mr. Trump on the stand. So, I mean, this is going to be an interesting ride. A lot of people obviously talk about this being some kind of novel case. But if the government is doing its job, then it is trying to take the novelty out of the discussion. And if the defense is doing its job, it's going to try to insert a lot of this original concepts, the novelty ideas into this, because that's ultimately, I think, the battle they want the jury to have, whether or not this is so extraordinary of a case that we don't feel comfortable convicting someone, or this is actually a rather standard white-collar fraud case. We are ready to convict someone.
I love to discuss trial tactics. Thanks so much, Jeff. That's former federal prosecutor Jeff Tsai. The jury heard from three witnesses in this first week of trial, and in the courtroom listening to them all, Bloomberg legal reporter Patricia Hurtado. Pat, tell us about the first witness, David Pecker, the former publisher of the National Enquirer.
David Pecker was an essential witness for prosecutors. He set the stage to describe the backstory to this hush money payment that's allegedly been made to help Donald Trump buy and bury salacious stories that he felt could have hurt his campaign when he ran for president in 2016. We've all seen these supermarket tabloids, but David Pecker is describing a whole other world of checkbook journalists. You know, they would pay money to people, including limousine drivers, for stories about celebrities. And the number one celebrity in his book was Donald Trump, because he was so popular with their readers because of the Celebrity Apprentice as well as The Apprentice. So he describes in great detail having these conversations with Donald Trump over first finding out about Dino Sajidin, the Trump Tower doorman, and that he had claimed that he had a story that Trump had fathered a love child with an employee at Trump Tower. Even though that turned out to be not true, they paid him tens of thousands of dollars for silence. Second story happens to be Karen McDougal, who was a Playboy model, and Trump had had an affair with her sometime mid-2000, and Trump wanted that story buried. So Pecker does it as a favor and pays her off, but then becomes an issue of who's going to pay him back. And by the time Stormy Daniels comes along, he's not willing to pay any extra money. And he tells Michael Cohen, you're going to have to take care of this. I'm not going to. So basically, we have three people right during the campaign. And Pecker said he would be Trump's eyes and ears about salacious stories and certainly inform Trump about them.
Were they able to make any inroads on Cross?
Trump's lawyer, Emil Bove, tried to discredit, you know, accuracy of his memory as well as detail, apparently trying to highlight alleged inconsistencies in his story. For example, he brought out that Pecker may have not originally used the words catch and kill, which is what the terminology for these buy and bury, these salacious stories was. And there were some amazing moments in this testimony, including Pecker recalls he does a favor for Trump in 2015, leading up to the 2016 election, and they have a meeting at Trump Tower in August 2015 where they all discuss, he, Michael Cohen, and Trump, discuss this buy and bury scheme. And then he's invited to Trump Tower in January 2017, and he walks in and he sees Trump meeting with Mike Pompeo, who's going to be head of the CIA, Jim Comey, who at the time was director of the FBI, Sean Spicer, who was going to be Trump's spokesperson, as well as Rance Priebus, who was going to be chief of staff. And they're getting a briefing about a shooting at Fort Lauderdale Airport. Pecker's invited into the room, and Trump turns to them and he says, this guy is the publisher of the National Enquirer. He knows more than all of you. And he made it as a joke, but Pecker said none of them laughed. You know, even if he meant it as a joke, this meeting is going on as a national security briefing for Trump. And then he has the head of the National Enquirer waltz into his office in the middle of it.
That sounds like a story that might be in the National Enquirer. The second witness was on the stand briefly on Friday afternoon, but she worked for Trump for more than 20 years.
Rona Graff, Donald Trump's former chief executive assistant. She no longer works for Trump, but her lawyer was being paid for by the Trump Organization. Trump himself never sends emails. This woman did it for him. there are Trump Organization records of contact information, including Karen McDougal's cell phone numbers and address, as well as Stormy Daniels' phone numbers and address. So these are confirmed in Trump records, so he can't say he doesn't know who these people are. They're actually in the records. And if the prosecutor even asked, did you remember seeing Stormy Daniels at Trump Tower somewhere before 2015? And she did remember her, and she said, I knew that she was a porn star. And there was talk among the staff that this woman was a porn star. And then on cross-examination, Nichols tried to suggest that the reason that Stormy was there, it was because Trump likes to cast, quote-unquote, controversial people as candidates for the Celebrity Apprentice. And that the reason Stormy was there was as potential Celebrity Apprentice candidate. And it was an incredible moment. As she finished, she got up to leave. Trump rose from the defense table and stood up and went to walk over to greet her, seemed to shake her hand. And there was this awkward moment because the jury's sitting there, the judge is on the bench, but then it seemed like Trump might have thought better of trying to do this in the middle of the trial, in the middle of the courtroom well, but it was extraordinary. See, the defendant get up and walk over to meet and greet Rona Graff's former assistant, and he was smiling broadly.
I guess it was instinct, and then the reality of being the defendant set in. And the third witness, Michael Cohen's banker, will be back on the stand Monday, signaling we're at the documents part of the case now. Thanks so much, Pat. We will check back with you on Monday. That's Bloomberg legal reporter Patricia Hurtado. Coming up, the Chamber of Commerce sues the FTC over its non-compete ban. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
It's another thing to say you're working for Subway and you can't walk across the street and go to Jimmy John's and get a 20-cent raise. What tells that all about other than keeping wages down?
3 years ago, President Joe Biden signed an executive order encouraging the Federal Trade Commission to limit non-compete agreements that prohibit workers from switching jobs within an industry. Non-competes affect about 1 in 5 Americans, and Biden's opposition to them goes back to his time as vice president. Here he is in July of 2020.
All those blue-collar workers who got fed the line of malarkey the last 25 years by the Chamber of Congress that organized labor is their problem, all of a sudden they're figuring out, I'm not a labor union member. Why do I have to sign a non-compete agreement if I make hamburgers and I want to go from one place to another?
And on Tuesday, the FTC voted to adopt a near ban on non-compete clauses, saying it will impact about 30 million Americans and increase worker earnings by more than $400 billion over 10 years. But on Wednesday, the Chamber of Commerce sued the FTC, challenging the rule in the latest battle between the business community and the Biden administration. Joining me is Bloomberg reporter Leah Nylin. Leah, tell us about the FTC's ban on non-competes.
Yeah, so the FTC voted to adopt a nearly complete ban on non-competes going forward. So after the rule goes into effect, there will be no more non-competes, which are essentially just clauses in employee contracts that forbid them from switching jobs within an industry. There's a couple tiny carve-outs. One, if you are an executive who is currently subject to a non-compete, and they define an executive as somebody who makes more than $150,000 per year and has a policy position within your organization, you can still be subject to your current non-compete, but executives going forward cannot enter into new ones. And the other sort of tiny caveat they made is if you are selling a business, you can be subject to a non-compete because they're trying to prevent essentially, you know, a thing where somebody who is a startup founder or something sells their business to someone and then goes out the next day and starts the same business under a different name. You know, businesses do want a little bit of comfort that when they buy something, they're getting all of the assets and sort of knowledge there.
Many people still think of non-competes as being for executives, people with trade secrets, but nowadays they even apply to blue-collar workers and minimum wage workers.
Yes, the FTC started this initiative a couple years ago. They started it with a workshop in which they had academics who had studied this come in. And they also had some state lawmakers, because before now, non-competes were largely regulated at the state. And it was actually a pretty interesting workshop that happened during the Trump administration. The attorneys general from Illinois and a couple other states talked about how they had found that there were like a weird proliferation of these in a lot of, as you mentioned, like minimum wage jobs. There ended up being a pretty famous one involving the sandwich chain Jimmy John's, in which it was trying to prevent its sandwich makers from going anywhere else that made sandwiches. They had a pretty detailed list of things that they couldn't do, including like making pitas or making hoagies. All of these different types of sandwiches, you couldn't go somewhere else that made them. They found out in Washington State, people were doing it at coffee shops. You know, they didn't want baristas moving around. It's fairly common among hairdressers. So yes, while it's sort of associated with executive and very like well-compensated employees, it had really like proliferated around the economy to a lot of lower wage jobs, and even some that you might be surprised by, like doctors and nurses, were often being asked to sign non-competes.
Well, sandwich makers also surprises me. And Biden was pushing the FTC for this non-compete ban.
Yes, Joe Biden signed this executive order his first year, the executive order on competition. And he actually says in some of his public speaking that the thing that first made him very interested in the issue of competition was when he was on the campaign trail, hearing from a number of workers who had mentioned to him non-competes. And that really sort of struck him as wrong. You know, like non-competes are a fundamental restraint of trade, as people say. You know, it is literally preventing a worker from going out and trying to get a better job that pays them well. And particularly when you have, you know, people who have skills that require some kind of licensing within a state, like medical or even hairdressers, you know, when you move, if you try and move out of state to get another job, you have to go through the process of getting your recertification. It's very expensive. So these non-competes can have a pretty serious impact on people's everyday lives when you really can't go and work for a competitor.
But this was a narrow 3-2 vote. It went down party lines.
Yes. So the FTC is a 5-member body. It has 3 Democrats right now because the Democrats are in the majority, and then 2 Republicans. And they did vote along party lines. Both of the Republicans gave public statements during the open commission meeting earlier this week. And they said that while they sort of agree in principle that non-competes are problematic, they are concerned that the FTC does not have the authority to issue this type of rule. And that is what various lawsuits that have now been filed challenging the rule have also said, because there is a little bit of a question about whether the FTC statute as written would allow them to have this rule.
So the Chamber of Commerce, the nation's largest business lobby, is one of those suing. Is that what they're alleging, that the FTC just doesn't have the authority here?
Yes, they have 2 major arguments, the first being the FTC does not have the authority to issue this type of rule. So the FTC says it does because the FTC Act allows them to prohibit what are known as unfair methods of competition. And so in the rule, they said this is an unfair method of competition. And the FTC Act also has another section that says that they are allowed to issue rules and regulations to help enforce the law. So to the Democrats on the FTC, they think that makes it pretty clear that they are allowed to issue a rule of this type. The Republicans say, you know, historically, the FTC has prohibited unfair methods of competition by individual enforcement actions. And very rarely has it actually gone through with rulemaking. The last time they had a rulemaking that used this unfair methods of competition statute on its own to make a rule was something like the 1970s. And generally, they make rules under some of their other authorities. So that is like one half of the Chamber of Commerce's lawsuit. The other half is, you know, the Supreme Court in a case recently said that they have concerns when agencies act on major questions. And so the Chamber of Commerce is also sort of challenging the FTC's non-compete ban under this major questions doctrine. You know, that's the idea that if Congress really did want you to solve this major question, they would have been very, very explicit in the statute that this was the sort of action that the agency could take.
And also, the Supreme Court, the conservative members of the Supreme Court, are on sort of a mission against the administrative state. And there are several cases involving the reach of agency power. So do people you've talked to think that the chamber has a good case here?
It's pretty much right now falling along party lines. You know, the FTC did have a challenge to its authority to make rules back in the 1970s. That took place here in the D.C. Circuit. That's part of the reason why the chamber opted to sue in Texas, which is in the more conservative Fifth Circuit, because if they had filed here, you know, they would probably refer back to this 1970s case that says, yes, we think the FTC has this authority. But by filing in a new circuit, you know, they can sort of have that circuit take the question up anew, potentially creating a circuit split that they could then take up to the Supreme Court.
And what other groups are suing besides the chamber?
So the Chamber of Commerce and the Business Roundtable are two, alongside some local chambers of commerce in Texas. That's how they got venues in Texas. There was also a tax firm that filed its own lawsuit. We've been getting a couple others of various people who are filing. When the FTC announced this, there were a bunch of business groups that came out against it, including HR professionals associations. A lot of professional associations, like actuaries, things like that, came out against the idea of banning non-competes.
So the non-compete ban is supposed to add hundreds of billions of dollars to workers' earnings. Is that why business groups are mostly against it, or are there other reasons besides money, money, money?
The business groups say that non-compete are useful for sort of protecting business information. So, you know, you don't really want to hire an employee and then have them the next day go across the street to your biggest rival and tell them all of your customers or your business plans and strategy. The FTC says in response, there are all sorts of other laws that you could use to address that, trade secret law, non-solicitation clauses, things like that. So you don't really need a non-compete, which effectively bars them from taking another job. The other aspect that the FTC left open in the rule is that you could offer an employee garden leave, is sort of what it's known as, which is where you are requiring them not to take another job for a certain period of time, but you are continuing to pay them either a salary or some sort of compensation to make up for the fact that they can't take this other job. That way, when they go to a new employer, the information they have about your company is at least a little bit dated.
As part of the rulemaking process, there was a solicitation of public comments. Tell us about that.
Yes. So the FTC got 26,000 comments, which is a lot for the FTC. Oftentimes, they put out for public comments and only get a couple hundred. So they were pleasantly surprised that they got 26,000. Of the 26,000, 25,000 were actually in support of the rule, which is one of the things that they cited for a reason why they felt comfortable moving forward with this. And in the rule itself, they cited a bunch of them from individuals who talked about how non-competes had significantly impacted their lives, preventing them from taking, you know, other jobs, or when they did try and take another job, they got sued. As I mentioned before, a lot of non-competes before this rule were really handled on a state-by-state basis. And because of that, you know, you would often have to go to court to see if a non-compete was enforceable or not. And the average person doesn't have a lot of experience with courts or suing over contracts. And so when, you know, an employer might threaten to sue them, that was sometimes enough to keep them from trying to change jobs because they don't really want to have to deal with that.
And explain how broad an effect the FTC or the Biden administration expects this to have on the workplace.
So the FTC did some of its own calculations on how broad this might be. They estimated that it would impact wages to the tune of $400 billion over the next 10 years. They also said that they think that it may help with small business formation, because when people are no longer subject to a non-compete, they can go out and start their own businesses in the same industry. And so they had some research that they did showing that it would increase new business formation by as much as 2.7% a year. So their findings were largely that this would have a positive impact on the economy.
We'll see if the chamber's lawsuit stops it from going into effect. Thanks so much, Leah. That's Bloomberg reporter Leah Nylin. This is the second time in 2 months that the Chamber of Commerce has sued over a Biden administration rule. Last month, the chamber filed a lawsuit challenging the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau rule that caps credit card late fees at $8 for the largest issuers. And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Show. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news on our Bloomberg Law podcasts. You can find them on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at www.bloomberg.com/podcast/law. And remember to tune into the Bloomberg Law Show every weeknight at 10 p.m. Wall Street time. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.